All right. Well, first, I'd like to thank the organizers very much for having us all here and putting together what's been a really fantastic conference so far. To those of you still using the print schedules, apologies, I'm not Ed Witten. there's been a slight change to the schedule. But today, I'll be telling you about what we've termed bespoke dual resonance for reasons that will become clear. And this talk will be based off of two papers that I've written in collaboration with Cliff Chung of Caltech. One is to appear shortly, and that will occupy the first roughly two-thirds of the talk, and the other is this recent February paper. So in the quantum field theory, we build amplitudes as the sum of channels of different topologies, S-channel, T-channel, et cetera. And these are topologically distinct diagrams, and we add them to get an amplitude. But in string theory, something quite different happens. Instead, the two topologies, S and T-channel, are indistinguishable due to the world sheet. At cartoon level, you can kind of squash the S-channel diagram into a T-channel one. And this goes by the name of dual resonance. And it's a magical property among many of string amplitudes that sort of received wisdom sets them apart as unique. But what we would love to do is actually prove that string theory is in some sense unique. And so to do that, we have to actually dive back into these unique aspects of string amplitudes and see if we can build other objects that satisfy this. So let's ask ourselves, what is it that string amplitudes do? Concretely, string amplitudes achieve all of their miracles by adding a tower of massive higher spin degrees of freedom. And famously, massive higher spin degrees of freedom are tricky. You can't really add just one without making your amplitudes behave even worse in the UV. So by adding an infinite tower, strings manage to circumvent this problem beautifully. And Veneziano first showed us how to do this in 1968, before it was even realized that this was a theory of strings at all. He wrote down this amplitude in order to essentially accommodate various observations about meson spectra that were being observed. But what we want to ask in this talk is, how unique is Veneziano's amplitude? And in particular, what is the math question about the S matrix to which string amplitudes are the answer? Right. So things you might be thinking about in terms of what makes string amplitudes unique. And for the purposes of this talk, we'll just be focusing on tree-level, planar string amplitudes. You might be thinking of dual resonance, the infinite towers of massive higher spin states. Maybe you're thinking of tame UV behavior, straightforward generalization to endpoint, world sheet representations. And also, you might be wondering what properties of Veneziano amplitudes actually enable these miracles. And maybe you think it's the Regi spectrum. And maybe if we deviate from the Regi spectrum, all of this is ruined. It turns out none of that will be true. In fact, in this talk, we'll construct non-stringy amplitudes that satisfy all of the properties marked in blue above, even while exhibiting customizable non-Regi spectra, which is, at least to us, very surprising. So this leaves the question of what is it that uniquely fixes string amplitudes out of all possible functions an open one. And we now have this plethora of other objects to understand. Are they somehow part of string theory? Are they something else? What is it that they describe? And this is life. This is what you have to do if you want to somehow prove that string theory is unique. You have to try and build all these other objects. Right. So let's look a little bit more closely at dual resonance. So dual resonance is, as we've shown, deeply tied to the asymptotic scaling of the amplitude in the Regi limit of large S but fixed T. So the reason for this is as follows. So if you have an amplitude that is crossing symmetric with tree-level poles on the S and T channels, then as long as the residue at S equals infinity is well-defined, you can write down an unsubtracted dispersion relation. You can evaluate A of S and T in terms of its own residue at S prime equals S. And here, this will turn into the imaginary part of that amplitude. And so you plug in some polynomial residue on each pole. And what you get is that the amplitude equals just the sum on the S channel alone plus this A infinity term, this residue at infinity. So this is what we'll mean by dual resonance in this talk. And for string amplitudes, first I should mention, these R functions are polynomials. We'll require a finite number of states on each resonance, just like in string theory. And because of that, you actually need an infinite number of poles in order to resum the propagator. So dual resonance, as soon as you invoke crossing, immediately implies that there's an infinite tower of massive higher spin objects. But I was going to say, for string amplitudes, of course, A infinity is zero because of the famous exponentially soft scaling in the Reggie limit, at least for negative t. And we can write out these R polynomials explicitly in terms of Stirling numbers, which I've written in square brackets there. So what we're essentially asking in this talk is it possible to choose different mu of n, so different spectral functions, for string theory, mu of n equals n, but we'll ask about arbitrary functions, and arbitrary polynomials R that still accomplish all the miracles of the string. All right, so let's do that. So first, we're going to see how we can actually vary the spectrum while still retaining these beautiful properties. So let's define a function, f, that we'll call the spectral curve, whose zero locus will fix the spectrum of the theory. So this function has two arguments, mu, which is a kinematic argument, and nu, which will be a level argument. So in particular, for the purposes of this talk, we'll pick a simple f. We'll pick it to be p of nu minus mu q of nu, where p and q are just some polynomials. So the spectrum here is just a rational polynomial, p over q. And if we'll further choose p and q to be monic, meaning that their highest degree coefficient is just 1. We'll further pick p to be of degree h and q to be of degree h minus 1, so that the spectrum is asymptotically Reggie. It can do whatever you want for the first finitely many terms. You can fix the first 10 or 100 arbitrarily, but ultimately it asymptotes to Reggie. And the reason we picked that is because there's this beautiful paper by Simone, who's here, and friends, who proved that essentially this asymptotic Reggie spectrum is in some sense unique. Now, as I said, for sufficiently large h, we can fix as many masses arbitrarily as you like. All right, so what are we going to do with this spectral curve? Well, let me write it as a product over its roots. Since it's monic, I can just write it as nu minus nu alpha of mu, where alpha just indexes the different roots, so alpha runs from, in our notation, 0 to h minus 1. So nu, here the root function, is a function of mu. So mu will take on the roles of s and t. And we observe that when s or t is on one of the poles, there is some nu alpha in the set of nus that equals n. So what we're going to do is we're going to replace the kinematics in the Veneziano amplitude by these roots of the polynomial. So I'm going to replace s with this root that will look like s plus root s plus whatever radical you have depending on the degree of the polynomial you've chosen. And we'll do the same with t. Now, doing that for one root is obviously very sick because it leads to branch cuts all over the place in the amplitude. But what we're then going to do is we're going to sum each argument over the Galois group of the roots of f. So we're going to sum over all the different roots. And by doing that, we actually cancel all of the branch cuts. So this will define our amplitude. For the rest of this talk, I'll refer to this as a bespoke amplitude, because you get to choose the spectrum. And we, again, have simple poles at s or t equals mu of n. Further, interestingly, and this wasn't required, but it's just a beautiful fact, we can write our amplitude in a remarkable D-log form as a kinematic transformation of the Mandelstam variables. So here, these D-log integrals are contours that are infinitesimal circles around the zeros of f of s comma sigma and f of t comma tau, where you integrate over the sigma and tau planes. All right. So that defines these objects that I claim are healthy amplitudes. Now let me prove to you that they actually are. So first, let's talk about asymptotics. The string amplitudes, as I've said, scale exponentially. What do the roots do in this limit? Well, one of them, which we'll call nu naught, just asymptotes to s. The other h minus 1 roots just go to the s-independent roots of q of nu. So the Reggie limit of our bespoke amplitude is just the Galois sum over the individual Reggie limits dictated by the roots. And what this means is that in order for dual resonance to happen, where we need A infinity of t, the residue at infinity, to be well defined, we need all the real parts of the roots to be negative over whatever range of t we want dual resonance to happen. So for example, over all t negative. This problem is the central problem in control theory. So there exists reams of mathematical literature telling you how to determine whether the roots of a polynomial have negative real part. And so you can look up Hurwitz stability, Kurytnov's theorem, etc. And if we've chosen P and Q such that this is true, and again, it's easy to check these criteria, then indeed we have a dual resonant amplitude, and A infinity of t is just the Veneziano amplitude evaluated at nu beta of t, and summed on the alpha, excuse me, on the S independent roots of Q. Right. What about the residues themselves? So, given, as I've said, given F satisfying the control theory conditions, we have a dual resonant representation. The branch cuts all cancel, and you can see that in the S-channel propagators here. You can rewrite this root sum as just this log derivative of the spectral curve. But what about the residues on the S-channel poles? What about those T-dependent polynomials? Well, you can prove that all the branch cuts cancel as a consequence of Galois theory, specifically the fundamental theorem of symmetric polynomials. But more directly, we can just calculate it. We can calculate the residues using this expression here, where the dk of t are the power sums of the roots, which can all be computed using Newton's identities that date back hundreds of years. They can be written in this nice determinant form in terms of our p's and q's, and you can see it's clearly just a polynomial in t. Good. There's one other comment I'll make about the residues, which is that we can use the d-log form of the amplitude to our advantage to actually compute explicitly the coefficients of t to the k in this polynomial. We can take the d-log form of the residue itself and expand the contour to tau equals infinity and explicitly just calculate those residues at infinity. Right, so now let's talk about some examples here. The simplest nonlinear model is for the choice h equals 2. H equals 1 is trivial, that's just Veneziano. So for h equals 2, we get a quadratic rational polynomial, and a particularly nice choice is to choose these coefficients so that the spectral function is just n squared over n plus 1 up to some shift. This is a nice choice. Among other reasons, it enjoys a duality symmetry if you swap n plus 1 for 1 over n plus 1. But beautifully, the residue at infinity, if you plug this into our formalism, is just a quartic contact term, which is not there in the Veneziano amplitude. So here, we have a dual resonant representation of this particular object up to some quartic contact term. So that's sort of cute. And you can check partial wave unitarity. You can read off all the partial waves up to whatever maximum level you want to go to, and you can convince yourself that indeed partial wave unitarity is satisfied for delta in this range. This depends on what we choose for the external masses. Here I've quoted you the result for external masses equal to 0. It also depends on dimension. This is the result in 4-dimension. In higher dimensions, the range will narrow. Right, so here, let's be slightly more general, and I'll write down a general h equals 2 model. So there are 3 free parameters, 4 if you count the external masses. And so we can recast these 3 parameters in terms of just the first 3 masses in the theory, mu0, mu1, mu2. And so there's some region that satisfies partial wave unitarity. Another nice parameterization is expanding around the asymptotics. So if we expand in series around the asymptotic spectrum for now a general H theory, I can write it in terms of these kappas. So here I've chosen a particularly simple choice for the Q polynomial. I've just made it n minus some shift up to raised to some arbitrary power. And what I'll do just to cut down the parameter space to something manageable, I'll set the external masses to 0, and I'll also zero out the 0, 0, and 1, 1 partial waves. And in that case, unitarity and dual resonance require nu star, this parameter, to be in this range in the h equals 2 case. For the h equals 3 case, we have some 2-dimensional region that's allowed. For h equals 4, we have a 3-dimensional region that's allowed, etc. So this is all just to convince you that there are indeed regions, islands of parameter space in this set of models that obey dual resonance and unitarity. One other comment I'll make is is about how stiff this spectrum is relative to the string spectrum. And one way of parameterizing that is to fix the first h masses to be on a line with slope lambda, and we can see what's the allowed slope. So any deviation from one is a deviation from strings, because eventually it goes to slope equal to one. And we can see that for various choices of h, there's a certain range of allowed values of lambda. Everything to the left of the red line is forbidden, because those theories have spinning tachyons. And so we see that for a large enough h, this particular choice is forbidden. Okay. I also claim that this setup allows us to naturally generalize to higher points, which is really surprising. Now, what we'll do is we'll write the basis of Mandelstams in the planar basis, so only objects that can appear on a planar cut in the diagram. I'll write that planar basis as S with a capital I. So the four-point basis is just S12 and S23. Etc. In general, at endpoint, you have n times n minus 3 over 2 planar invariants. And what we'll do is we'll start off by taking the higher point string amplitude written here, and we'll remap each planar invariant by the roots of our polynomial, and then we'll do the Galois sum on each individual planar invariant in the basis. And this can also be written in terms of this multi-D-log contour integral. So we can see how this works in practice. But first, I'll mention that this also allows us to write down a worldsheet representation. So recall the worldsheet integral form of the Veneziano amplitude here. And the product structure of the integrand allows our Galois sum to factorize so that we can talk about, instead of modifying the amplitude, we can talk about just modifying the integrand and think about this as some kind of worldsheet integral. We don't know for what theory. We don't know the Hamiltonian, so we haven't derived this as a worldsheet theory. But it's suggestive that one might exist. So here we can see how this works at four-point. And at endpoint, what the prescription is take your Sijs and write them in the planar basis. Then the Kolbe-Nielsen integral that we see in string theory contains all of these factors in its integrand, these xi minus xj raised to the sij power. And the prescription is to send this to this special function rho, which is this power sum over the roots. So for example, at 5-point, here's the 5-point string amplitude. It depends on 5 Mandelstam invariants. You can write the integrand in this form. And what you're supposed to do in our prescription is make all of these substitutions in terms of the rows. And here we have a 5-point bespoke amplitude for arbitrary spectra. And it enjoys the same sort of dual resonance properties that the 5-point string amplitude does. And you can also, I should add, you can immediately check that factorization works as well. So for the Veneziano amplitude, at the level of the amplitude itself, factorization has only been checked for the n equals 0 state using amplitudes tools. And similarly, we can do the same thing for our bespoke amplitudes. We can check that factorization holds in the exact same way up to normalizations that can be trivially reabsorbed. Right. So that's what I had to say about these sort of custom spectrum amplitudes. But that construction used the Veneziano amplitude as kind of the seed to then get all these other objects. What about the Veneziano amplitude itself? Where does that famous gamma gamma over gamma structure come from, and is there some way to naturally motivate it, other than the fact that it works? What we would like to do is motivate that from first principles using very basic assumptions of crossing symmetry, polynomial residues, and high energy boundedness. So what we'll do is we're going to assume a linear spectrum, m squared equals n. And as we've shown, dual resonance is intimately connected with the anomalously soft behavior at infinity of the string amplitude. So we're going to assume a dual resonant ansatz and then see whether we naturally get the correct residues of the string. So in order to impose crossing, we a priori have a two-variable complex analysis problem, which we would like to turn into a single-variable problem. We'll do that by picking a particular value of t. So then, imposing crossing and sort of massaging the sums among each other, we can write this crossing equation in this form. And we note a couple things. The right-hand side contains a finite number of terms with no poles at s equals n less than k, whereas the left-hand side doesn't a priori satisfy that, so demanding the same of the left-hand side, demanding, that is, no poles at s equals n less than or equal to k, yields the following set of consistency criteria on the residues. Now, strictly speaking, this is neither necessary nor sufficient for crossing. It's not sufficient because I've imposed crossing at fixed t rather than arbitrary t. It's not necessary because, strictly speaking, these residue sums are convergent either for t less than 0 or as residues on the poles at s for generic t, not necessarily for arbitrary t equal to an integer, which is what we've done here. Nonetheless, we'll press forward, we'll take this as sort of handed to us, and we'll see what we find. And indeed, we'll find that the Veneziano amplitude arises naturally from this consistency criterion, but fortunately or not, other objects do too. So even fixing the spectrum, fixing the Chu-Frauchi plot, so m squared equals n spins 0 to n, does not uniquely fix string theory, and Veneziano could have mentioned this back in 68, that there are other objects that are dual resonant with the exact same spectra as observed in the mesons. So okay, let's see what this gets us. We have n conditions on the n plus 1 free parameters of the ansatz. So we have some freedom. Let's define lambda m as lambda m comma m here in the polynomial. For brevity, for the rest of this talk, I'll pretend the factorial is can take real values rather than just integer input. And we find the following general solution for the residues. And you can play with this numerically, and you find that for arbitrary lambda m, as long as you choose them such that the infinite sum converges, you get dual resonant amplitudes. So we have an infinite parameter family of novel dual resonant amplitudes with linear spectra. So where do strings come from? Well, they come from the fairly simple choice of picking lambda m equals 1 over m factorial. In that case, you can get the string residues from the Vandermonde identity, and cycling through a bunch of identities, you get the Veneziano amplitude pretty quickly. But as I said, there are other choices of lambda m. Roughly speaking, to make the sums converge, you need lambda m to fall off as order 1 over m factorial. That's what you find numerically. So a natural choice would be to pick lambda m equals 1 over m plus r factorial. And let's, for fun, rescale it by r factorial because it'll make things nice. In that case, the residue also has a beautiful closed form expression. And from the definition of the generalized hypergeometric function, the amplitude takes this form here. Now this is not obviously crossing symmetric, but it turns out that it is using a Tomei transformation, which allows us to write the amplitude as Veneziano times this 3F2 dressing factor, which is obviously crossing symmetric. So this is a new dual resonant amplitude that has the exact same spectrum as string theory. We've called it the hypergeometric amplitude in our paper for obvious reasons. And for r equals 0, this reduces back to Veneziano. Now you should worry about unitarity, but indeed it is unitary for lots and lots of values of r, so this is Veneziano, the partial waves, but for different choices of r, they're all positive, for r above some lower bound. So here I've plotted r versus m naught squared, where we've taken m naught and m external to be the same, and here I'm showing you the unitary region in different dimensions. So the black line is for d equals 4, everything colored is unitary. The dotted line is for d equals 26, so the orange dot is the bosonic string, the red dot is the superstring, and this purple dot is the interesting theory that sort of lives on the corner of the parameter space at r equals minus a half. It's from this perspective, just as compelling as the bosonic string in that it lives on a corner. But we would like to know more about that particular theory. This hypergeometric amplitude obeys beautiful Reggie scaling and high energy fixed angle scaling. We find again that for positive t, you get the universal behavior proven by Simone and friends. Whereas for negative t and r not equal to 0, you get power law behavior. So it's soft in the UV, but not as dramatically soft as the string. Even this amplitude might have a worldsheet interpretation, but in a somewhat weirder way than the bespoke Galois sum amplitudes I talked about earlier. So here, again, remember the Kobe-Nielsen form of the four-point Veneziano amplitude, and recall what the five-point form looks like. So here's the five-point amplitude, and I can write our hypergeometric amplitude as also an integral over two dummy variables that looks exactly like a five-point string amplitude, but evaluated at fixed kinematics. So I've set S12 to S, S23 to T, but the other three kinematic variables to constants. So I've taken a five-point string, done something to it, and gotten this new object. Finally, in the last minute, I'll mention the Kuhn amplitude. So all of the amplitudes I've talked about so far in this talk are meromorphic. They're actually analytic, but for just simple poles in the plane corresponding to the resonances. But this question about whether string amplitudes are in some sense the only game in town was asked in 1969 by Darryl Kuhn and then tragically forgotten for decades, where he Q-deformed everything in sight in the Veneziano amplitude. So his amplitudes are different in that they have a branch cut and an accumulation point. So they don't have just simple poles everywhere. People have speculated about whether that branch cut corresponds to an ionization process. I've looked at whether they can be constructed in string theory. And there's been a huge surge of interest in these amplitudes in recent years. I bring this up because the Kuhn amplitude can be unified with our hypergeometric story into a new set of Q-deformed hypergeometric amplitudes. So these are the objects in the green plane here, and this should be R on this axis, our parameter. So the hypergeometric amplitude is the orange line, Veneziano is the purple dot, and Kuhn's amplitude is the blue line there. So this subsumes all of those types of amplitudes, though notably does not contain the bespoke custom spectra amplitudes I talked about earlier. So I think I'm about out of time, so let me just remind you of sort of what we've done and what we would like to do next. We've constructed a new infinite parameter family, actually multiple families of amplitudes satisfying meromorphicity, crossing, polynomial residues, partial wave unitarity, UV boundedness, and dual resonance. Using our Galois sum construction, we found that the Regi spectrum is not sacrosanct. You can pick virtually any spectrum you like and still come up with healthy amplitudes that are kind of like strings. They generalize to endpoint and have apparently a worldsheet-like representation. Furthermore, from a sort of more fundamental bootstrap approach, we motivated the gamma-gamma over gamma structure of the string, but also found that there are these other objects as well, the hypergeometric amplitudes. And this is the path we have to tread in order to ultimately prove that string theory is the unique theory of quantum gravity, which is the goal. We have to see whether it can be bootstrapped from first principles. And along the way, we find all these other interesting objects that might conceivably give us new insights into string theory itself if it turns out that they're some deformation of the worldsheet. And so that's the next set of open questions that we look forward to investigating. Thanks.
Minutes for questions. Okay, this one back there, Suvret.
Yeah. Sorry, can you say that again?
Yeah, sorry. So actually, first of all, thanks for a very nice talk. It seemed implicit in the conditions, in the requirements that you imposed, that these amplitudes would also automatically satisfy the right causality constraints.
Ah, okay.
Could you please explain why that's the case? Why is it that you don't have to impose that separately and it follows
right,
from
right.
What
you when people talk about causality at the level of scattering amplitudes, they mean different things. So sometimes people mean just analyticity, in which case our amplitudes manifestly satisfy that. But more generally, so Nima is fond of pointing out to people that if I hand you an arbitrary function of st and u, there is no known algorithm to tell you whether or not that function came from a fundamentally causal theory or not. So at that level, we can't, as much as can be said at the level of scattering amplitudes in terms of causality, we've said it. Oh yeah. Oh no. That will that any EFT-hedron type bounds, for example, are manifestly satisfied for any chosen set of parameters that's in the region that satisfies partial wave unitarity.
Okay, we have a question from Zoom. David?
Hi, David.
Hi, Glenn. Great talk.
Thanks.
But I wanted to make a remark, which we've discussed before, that you really shouldn't claim unitarity,
right,
but rather constraints of unitarity. Positivity constraints following from unitarity. To check unitarity, you would have to, so you find a four-point amplitude poles, sort of n of order n poles at mass squared equals m, n, correct?
I'm sorry,
and
yeah.
You decompose the pole into Gegenbauer polynomials,
right,
you know, mass nj.
Right.
But here, of course, the number of particles, number of states at each value of n grows like e to the n. And you only can see that by looking at multiparticle scattering amplitudes and proving that there's a...
Yeah, so, you know, so you're talking about higher, effectively higher loop effects, right?
All I'm saying is you, to continue to prove unitarity, not positivity constraints,
right?
Two-point amplitude.
You would have to
look at an exponential number of, the multiplicity of states you find in string theory goes like e to the n.
Right. Certainly. All we wish to claim is that our amplitudes are consistent with partial wave unitarity. That's all we can say.
Okay. But you keep saying they're unitary. And the but to really prove that the theory is unitary, for large n,
yeah,
large poles that grow linearly, you'd have to look at e to the order of e to the n positivity constraints for each,
right,
n.
Yeah. As I've said, I think the next step would be actually for us to try and construct the theory. That's what we would like to do. But yeah.
But even at order, you know, the five-point amplitude, you could start trying to disentangle the degeneracy you're bound to find, which is presumably exponential.
Mm-hmm.
And if that satisfies the positivity constraints,
I see.
What could very well happen is that the allowed regions would shrink so much as you check more and more, exponentially more for large n, that it would shrink to string theory.
Yeah. Okay. Well. Right. So we've only actually checked 4-point positivity, I should say. So indeed, higher point positivity presumably. Is much more constraining. But also that sort of technology for even talking about 5-point partial wave unitarity is not super well developed in the literature. There's regrettably not all that much work on analyticity of higher point amplitudes. Indeed, Hofi and others who are here have been working on that sort of formalism, but...
That's in the bootstrap. But you also said you have specific generalization, specific endpoint amplitudes.
Right. There's a natural endpoint candidate amplitude that you get by applying the same Galois sum formalism to the endpoint Kobe-Nielsen form of the string amplitude.
So all I'm saying is that if you then try to isolate a pole, which is, say, n particles goes to n particles.
Sure, yeah.
Those poles, you will be able to disentangle e to the n states, each of which has to have a positive residue.
Right. As far as I know, that hasn't even been done, at least using amplitudes technology for the Veneziano amplitude.
It was done originally by Fubini and Veneziano.
Sorry?
The technology developed by Fubini and Veneziano, which led to.
Right, right.
It also was a proof. It was a way of disentangling the proof that worked for certain or critical strains or the correct intercept and slope, et cetera. could have been done that way as well.
Yeah, it could have. But as far as I know, it hasn't been done using strictly amplitudes methods and without using string theory itself.
In the end, they had a consistent theory.
You're right.
So
exactly.
Negate. Right. I mean, you have bounds. You have regions which work and regions that don't work. And you could strengthen those bounds, I believe, exponentially by imposing constraints on, say,
Absolutely.
Set it up in a symmetric way, so it has to be positive, but you have a lot more invariance to play with.
Right.
I
agree with everything you're saying. It's just not clear to me yet whether doing that in a systematic way and developing all that technology is easier or harder than actually just trying to construct the theory for one of these relatively simple polynomials. But in any case.
Depends whether you're looking to construct new theories or to prove uniqueness.
Yeah.
Okay, I think I will cut the discussion off in interest of time, but invite further questions after the formal session. So
sounds good.
Let's thank Grant again.